Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up, we recently celebrated the 50th anniversary of one of the most important chapters of LGBT history. It's the subject of a play that was performed at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts this year. We'll also talk about Illinois' history with sundown towns, places where Black citizens were not safe if they stayed in the town after dark. But first, just over 100 years ago, the war to end all wars ended. A year after that, the American Legion was founded. It played a big role in our nation's history, not just as the largest veterans organization in the country, but also because its members helped create things like the GI Bill and the Department of Veterans Affairs. Today, there are millions of members, and there are American Legion posts in towns big and small where veterans gather and host community events. And some of those veterans are the subject of a book called American Legion by Evanston photographer Mariah Carson. She joined us last fall on Veterans Day. Hi, Mariah. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thank you for having me.
Mariah, there's so many possible stories to try and document when it comes to our veterans. How did you land on deciding to focus on the American Legion?
Well, I wanted to do something to honor those that served our country, and I became interested in the American Legion because they are the largest wartime veterans association with over 13,000 posts across the United States. Out of those 13,000 posts, though, there are only a handful of physical posts that remain, and a lot of those are in small communities scattered across the United States. So I was interested in documenting these smaller American Legion posts, and I selected four, all in towns with populations of less than 1,000 in very different communities across the United States.
And so one of those communities is Franklin Grove, Illinois. That's about an hour south of Rockford. What can you tell us about Franklin Grove?
Franklin Grove is a small farming community. They have a very tight-knit group that keeps their Legion post going. They only have about 28 members there. And a lot of their members are older. There's several World War II vets and a few Korean and Vietnam veterans that are active participants. But they are a very small post, but they're struggling to keep alive and vibrant. And I'm excited tonight to drive out there and go to their Veterans Day supper.
Mariah, when we think about small towns in particular, why did you want to focus on small towns and American Legion posts?
Oftentimes in small communities, the American Legion post can be the community center or meeting place or sometimes the only bar or restaurant in the community. So I was curious, as everybody is getting older and it's increasingly difficult to run a bar or a public space or to keep up with a building when most of the people that are in charge of it are volunteers and past retirement age. So I was curious how the posts actually influence the community and to document them at this time, knowing that there is a possibility that unless more people become interested in the American Legion, that these posts might not exist in the next 15 to 20 years.
Right. So I know that when we're thinking about in the last 20 years, looking at American Legion membership, it's dropped from 3.1 million to, I think, is it about 2.2 million now, Mariah?
Yes.
And I think you say in your book, which has these lovely photographs that I want to get to in just a minute, that we think about the demographic of, we think about World War II veterans, they're dying at a rate of 640 a day. And I imagine that's been the most loyal group of people who have gone to the American Legion, Mariah?
Yes, that's correct. And less than 1% of the current population serves in the U.S. military. So the pool of potential members is getting smaller and smaller, along with the fact that most young people don't really join fraternal organizations or really any kind of community-involved organization.
I'm speaking with Mariah Carson. She's a photographer who lives in Evanston. Her photography book we're talking about, it's called American Legion, and it documents through these beautiful photographs. Mariah, can I ask you, you mentioned before about dinner, and sometimes in these small towns, the American Legion might be the only restaurant or bar. This happened to you. You were in Nebraska a couple of years ago, about 5 years ago. Is that kind of what prompted the idea for this book as well?
Yes. I was driving past an American Legion post, and I saw an elderly man outside mowing the lawn. And I had gotten out of my car to take a few pictures, and he asked me what I was doing and invited me for supper at the post and apologized in advance that service might be slow, but they were really struggling to keep themselves open. But a lot of younger people didn't really want to get involved. And throughout my drive through Nebraska, I saw in every small town an American Legion post. And it made me increasingly curious about what was going on in these small communities, that they had enough veterans to support having a physical structure and how it was the center point of their communities.
Mm. And so when you went to Franklin Grove, you started talking to a bunch of different veterans there. One of the veterans who you spoke with, his name is Willard Simpson. He's from Fairfield,
yeah.
Right?
He was originally from Fairfield, and he is a current resident of Franklin Grove.
And he actually served in the unit that I think for people who, a lot of people know Band of Brothers, a very popular HBO TV series. How did he wind up serving in World War II, Mariah? I imagine he's part of a generation. You were just mentioning that now less than 1% of the country belongs to the military, but in World War II, it was a very different story.
It was a very different story in World War II, in Korea and in Vietnam, in that a lot of people were drafted into service. So Willard was drafted into service, and he was quite young. He was a farm boy, and he was kind of thrown into this situation in Europe on this great journey that he went on to serve in the U.S. military.
Mariah, I can't even begin to imagine what a lot of service members have seen during conflicts they took part in, and I imagine especially for World War II veterans, you hear a lot of stories about men who are not, they're reluctant to share details, which is understandable. Was Willard like that when you first met him?
When I first met Willard, he told me that he hadn't really spoken too much about his service. And when I did a more formal interview with him, I sat in his kitchen with him and his wife, Maxine. And Maxine told me that Willard didn't really talk about his service, and that was fine with her because the only thing she wanted to know about World War II was General Patton. So at the time, Willard hadn't really spoken too much about his service to his family members, but after our visit, he was prompted to write a little bit of details of his experience and share them with his family.
And so he was a combat engineer when he was serving in Europe?
Yes, he was a tool room keeper, and he, from what I understand, he drove around on a truck and did whatever was asked of him at the time while serving in the army in France.
And so they told him, I understand I was I know you recorded some interviews with him, and we're going to play some of that in a minute, but did they tell him you're a farm boy, so you must be good with tools?
I don't think so. I think when you get drafted into the army, or when you join the army, you kind of do whatever you're told, no matter what. So I'm not sure if he was designated as a tool room keeper because he was from a farm, or if that's just how it ended up being. But I know that he liked the position because it was a slightly safer assignment in his division.
Mm. I'm speaking with Mariah Carson, a photographer, and we're talking to her about the veterans that she's photographed across American Legion posts. We're talking in particular about some veterans that she met in Franklin Grove, Illinois. And I wanted to play actually a clip of an interview that you did. We're talking about Willard and his story with Willard and his wife, Maxine. It actually starts off with Maxine talking about the letters and packages that she would send to Willard while he was in Germany.
My cousin lived in Northern Illinois at that time, and her family was down visiting. We wanted to take some pictures to send, and so we put our bathing suits on, went out in the yard and took pictures of each other. Oh, that was funny.
I don't remember getting one.
You don't want to. Everybody looks so terrible.
I don't remember getting one in a bathing suit, but maybe I did.
That's
it
how
seems
we
like you would remember the bathing suit on.
I think if you'd have got it, you'd have remembered. We were miles away from anywhere to swim. But we were trying to think things to do. So that I remember that one afternoon we did that.
I just liked the one she was wearing. She looked really dressed up and really looked pretty. So that's the one I liked.
That's World War II veteran Willard Simpson and his wife, Maxine. Mariah, what was it like to recall all of those memories with both of them, to have both of them sharing their experiences of World War II, Maxine as she was here and Willard as he was over there?
It was really impactful, and it really spoke to the difference of communication at the time, in that if Maxine wanted to talk to Willard, she had to write a letter, and it may or may not reach him in Europe. And it was also really touching. One of the photos that she had sent to him was a photo of her wearing a borrowed prom dress, standing under a trellis in her yard. And Willard had that throughout his boot camp experience. He had it on the ship that he sailed to go over to Europe and throughout his entire tour of service. And it is now in a memorial scrapbook that they put together for, I think it was their 50th wedding anniversary.
Right. That's the picture he was talking about, right? At the end of the audio we just played where he said she looked really pretty. Mariah, so you are from Evanston. You have military members in your family, right? Is that part of what inspired you wanting to do this?
Well, I actually, before I started the project, I didn't know that both of my grandfathers had served in the military. They had passed away when I was young. But I was interested in learning more about military culture because I didn't really know that much about it. And I wanted to do something that would serve as a long-lasting document, not only for the people that I was working with, but also for a greater audience to create an understanding of people that served our country and are often looked at as somebody that's in a uniform, but not in the context of who they became after their service and what their continued service to their community was like.
So is there something that you learned that you think more civilians, or especially as we think about how few families in this country are military families now, is there something you learned that you think people should keep in mind?
I think people should keep in mind, especially if they have any kind of negative association with war or with veterans, that a huge percentage of older vets did not join the military. They were drafted into service, and they did what they needed to do to serve our country. And that experience for them was so profound that oftentimes when they came home, they joined organizations like the American Legion, which is wonderful in supporting veterans back into an integration into society after this life-changing and possibly very traumatic experience. So I think that what I would like for people to think about is that just a little, if they can display a small amount of gratitude, even thanking somebody for their service, it really makes a huge difference in people's lives and in their self-esteem and to make them feel special and important because they are.
That's Maria Carson. She's an Evanston-based photographer. We have been talking about her photography book. It's called American Legion. We've been focusing on the communities that she shot, photographed, and documented in Illinois, in Franklin Grove. But they're all, she has four communities, as she said, all across the Midwest. We've got these, there's some lovely pictures, and we tweeted them out, and we'll have them at our website as well. Mariah, thank you so much for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla. Have a great afternoon.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You probably heard of the Stonewall Inn. The 6 days of rioting and disturbances in the summer of 1969 in and around Stonewall are commonly thought of as the beginnings of the LGBT civil rights movement. We just celebrated the 50th anniversary of it. President Obama designated the Stonewall Inn and surrounding areas in New York's Greenwich Village as the first ever monument to the LGBT movement. But how much do we actually know about what happened? Those events have been dramatized in a play called Hit the Wall. Back in January, when the play was at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, we sat down with the director, Robert Gerard Anderson. He's also an associate professor at the U of I's Department of Theater. Madeline Whitesell is the play's dramaturg and a master's student in the same department. She joined us as well. Gerard, Madeline, thanks for being here. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Great to be
Thank
here.
Thank you for having us.
Madeline, I want to start with you and just ask, what did you know about the history of this before you got involved in this play?
That's a good question. I knew very general ideas about the Stonewall Inn. I've been to New York before, so I'd been outside of it, and I'd seen it as a monument. I knew that it was a riot. I knew that it was some sort of catalyst for the LGBT rights movement. And I knew that it was part of the reason that pride parades happened. But outside of that, I didn't know much about it. And I think that a lot of the other students in the show share the same sentiments as me. It's not really something we're taught in schools. It's more kind of this mythology that we hear of and more of a story that we hear of than any sort of actual historical facts that we learn about.
Right. And Anderson, mm-hmm. I learned a lot from the play because right. I think lots of people have sort of a vague notion of Stonewall riots, LGBT civil rights. Why did you want to bring this play to the university?
Well, for lots of reasons. I love the playwright, Ike Holter. He's really a great emerging young playwright from Chicago. This is one of his first plays, but he writes a lot about race and gender and class and gentrification. And I love his work because it's funny and it's witty and it's incredibly potent politically, but it's also not preachy. I feel like there's a real sort of entertainment to it, and he's interested in the history and like who gets to own that history. So the playwright was a big reason. I also think that American universities are some of the most sort of homophobic and sort of transphobic and heteronormative places in the country. Even though we're very liberal, there's that stuff is still embedded. So I feel like we want to present plays here, and the students are usually so far ahead of us, including in terms of their understanding and their interest in these sorts of things. So I thought it would be a good play for us to do, for the students to explore the history, but also get their passion behind, because they have a lot of passion for these ideas. Our department also, one of our mission statements is we stand for radical inclusion. So we want to look at stories that are about people who have been on the margins, people who haven't been invited into the center, and playwrights who haven't been invited into the center of these conversations in terms of cultural conversations. I'm a gay man, too. I was brought up during this period. I was more affected by the AIDS crisis, but I think there are a lot of connections between this movement and then what happened later, the Stonewall and then the AIDS crisis. So I find a real connection between, like a personal connection between those things. So lots of reasons to do it. And it's just a damn good play.
Mm-hmm. When we think about what happened over that 6 day period, most everyone generally agrees on sort of the broad generalities of what happened, right? There was this club, Stonewall Inn. It was mostly frequented by gay men, although there were a few lesbians and transgender people who were also there. And at the heart of the play, there's this horrific confrontation, actually, not between the police and between gay men, but between a lesbian and transgender woman. I wonder if you guys could speak to why you think their also the focus of this, is you're talking about different people left on the margins of this.
I mean, I think the play works to include everybody, which I think is a great thing that the playwright does. I mean, I think he wants to place people of color at the center of the story because they were at the center of the story. And they have even been slightly, I think, rewritten by white gay activists.
You mean written out of the story?
Yeah, I think they have been. I think people do say, you know, black drag queens started this. But then it became really a movement that was supported primarily by white gay men. The movement then was sort of taken over in some way. And I don't know if it was completely rewritten, but the power was with white gay men after that. So I think that the playwright wanted to, and we certainly wanted to represent that as much as we could with our pool, the centrality of those people, of people of color, and also conversations that still exist in the LGBT community about race and class, and that those separations that are still there and potent. And then we have two trans actors who are in the show, and I think that adds some interesting sort of, I mean, they're amazing, and they were cast because they were the right people for the parts, but there's something about their presence, and I don't know if they would exist in the period that the play was set precisely as they do now. So we had to have some sort of deep conversations about how we are going to, the casting, the representation, their willingness to represent these characters and their sexual preference and all sorts of issues around who they were in the play.
Yeah, I think that another thing to add is that police brutality, especially towards transgender women of color, is much more prevalent. And I think that this play does a good job of representing that accurately and in the way that the police interact with the different characters and how they leave some alone and are much more brutal to other characters. And I think that has a lot to do with their race and their gender representation.
It's a pretty big cast.
Yep.
So
yeah.
We've been talking about two of the characters that are central to a lot of the action towards the end of the play. Whose eyes do we see this through? There's a lot of different characters here.
This is Ike's work, too, the playwright. There's sort of a Greek chorus of these two snap queens, which is a term used for certain kinds of gay men of that period and beyond. You might think of sort of like the kind of conversations that happen on RuPaul's drag show. It's that sort of persona. And they're played by a young African-American actor and a young Latinx actor. We don't necessarily see it through their eyes, but they kind of lead us through in some way, like a Greek chorus through the play. So sometimes they're doing direct address to the audience. Sometimes they're interacting with other characters. Sometimes they're just sort of like throwing shade on the side of the play.
Yeah, they're sort of like the color commentators throughout the entire play.
Like, you know, whatever,
play.
The Muppet Show or something. Yeah. I mean, it's really a brilliant conceit, but it also gives us the freedom to be able to have that commentary. So I think they're an important part of the kind of like the chorus of it. Yeah.
And Anderson, I know you've produced a lot of Shakespeare, and I was wondering about that because the cadence of,
yes.
I was thinking of it, it's almost like a spoken word rap battle, rapid fire speech. And I wonder how your background in Shakespeare was helpful for these folks in that cadence.
Well, it's so helpful. I mean, I think I was attracted to the play originally and all of his work because of the language. Just the wit and how quick it is and how a serious moment is embedded into all this humor and how people use language as a weapon and as a way to disclose things and as a way to fight and as a way to love and as a way to obfuscate what's happening. I just think it's the language, I think, is so brilliant and so fun and entertaining, but also can be brutal. And that is Shakespeare. It's that same Shakespeare training. So to have our students, some of who are new grad students working on this, along with Shakespeare, a lot of those skills and that training is shared.
Yeah, I think also for these characters, humor is often used as this protective armor, especially these characters on the street. It's what they use to cover up more hurt and anger.
I wonder if you all can also explain a little bit about the casting of this. You were talking about some of the different people who tried out play, this production of Hit the Wall. There's a deaf actor in this play. And then you also have screens throughout the entire studio theater, so the entire play is subtitled.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I don't know if that was the way the play was written or if that was something that you all changed with this production.
It was not the way the play was written. As I said, we have this commitment to inclusion and radical inclusion in our department. And so what that means in this case is that when we do our recruiting, we're looking at the best actors that we can bring here, no matter what their ability, how they identify, and also looking at people who aren't normally included in a pool of actors at an MFA. So with Andrew Morrill, who's an actor who happens to be deaf, he was the best actor that I saw in New York City at the URTAs, which are these big group auditions for resident university theater programs. So when I saw him, I envisioned, like, how are we going to do this? You know, and so he's been a great advocate for the deaf community here and elsewhere. So, you know, the deaf community in this area and in this region needs to know that whenever we do a play now with Andrew, we're going to try to have this closed captioning, which means they don't have to choose the night that they see the show, especially in a language show like this, to really get the language and the nuance of the language. So we were looking at casting him as this character, sort of a drifter that comes in, and he's a wonderful actor. In every community, there's certainly a presence of deaf people and signing the ASL world. But in the gay community, there is a real presence of gay deaf people. So I thought, you know, it could work. And then the actor who's playing sort of his love interest in the play learned ASL.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah, he learned the entire role in ASL. And the backstory that we just added, without really changing, I think, any of the text, that's his home language, that, like, he is a deaf family, or he came from a deaf community, you know, background. And so he knew it. So that's one of the reasons that they initially connected. Hopefully it sort of disappears as a special thing, and we just get into their story, which is what we hope happens and what I think happens.
Well, and in fact, it's an interesting layer that I think is actually a really powerful element in the play, because when they're communicating, it's silent. And much of the film, there's a live band that's sort of a soundtrack in the corner. As you said, there is this Greek chorus. There's a lot of stuff going on. So it actually creates such a different moment because of the silence and the way they're communicating.
Yeah, I love it. He's such a wonderful actor, and that's the number one thing about him, what he's contributing to the department and to the university, actually.
Going back to sort of our initial conversation about the different people and the different perspectives that are represented here, I couldn't help but just think of a parallel of how we've been talking about the Women's March and the second anniversary and how different groups have fragmented into feeling like they need to have their own march to represent their interests. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, as you think about the role of a dramaturg and adapting this, how you thought about that whole issue of intersectionality when it comes to this play and how it relates to today.
One of the lines from one of the characters, Roberta, is, "I went to the Black Panthers and they didn't want to listen to me." I won't say the actual line, but it's because she was gay. And then she says, "I go to the women's movement, and they said that our movement was too fragile right now for women of color, so I had to start my own movement." And I think that part of the reason the LGBTQ movement was formed was because they were rejected from other movements. This riot, Stonewall, brought together a lot of different groups of people that became fragmented throughout the movement, but this one event included a lot of different groups of people.
It really forced the hand, I think, of a lot of people that we have to come together for this. It's just the beginning of us coming together as a powerful source for each other. But then it did happen again during the AIDS crisis where, you know, lesbians were nursing gay men and helping them through the crisis. And we came together again as a group to try to solve things. But I feel like we continue to come together and come apart.
And as we think of this, I can't help but just think of the news, terrible incident in Chicago with the Empire actor. I don't know if you guys have...
I just saw that briefly, yeah.
Yeah, just been looking at the online conversation today about he's a gay Black man, so was this a racist attack? Was this a homophobic attack?
Sure.
It can be both.
Right.
And that's not necessarily always part of our conversation when we're thinking about these things.
Absolutely. I think that the idea of race and gender and all these things are still so troubling, and we're still trying to dissect them. And I think the play is a great format for us to be able to, like, sit and think about the contradictions that are still embedded into our discussion about all of these things.
Yeah, you can really see through the different interactions of the characters all of these intersections between race and gender within the gay community that a lot of times people from the outside would not know even exist, that these issues exist. Especially you can see the white privilege of someone like the character A-Gay versus some of the other queer characters of color, and that privilege that he has both with the cop and sexually and just living his life. And also the idea of being able to pass as straight gives him a certain amount of privilege that it doesn't give other people. So
we're still struggling, I think, as gay people and members of the LGBT community, as we're different. There's many different kinds of us. I've had to said so many times on this campus, I'm not that kind of gay, the one that they want me to be, the mouth that they want me to have, even the concerns that they want me to represent. And I think this play, especially the first half of the play, which is quite entertaining, actually points at that there's lots of conflict, there's lots of judgment, there's lots of different ways of presenting and representing and sharing your sexuality or not, that is in our community, that it is a diverse community, and not particularly functional sometimes, you know, and not together in some ways. And I think that's part of the thing the playwright was really interested in looking at, which is, I think, informative for people to experience, I think.
It's Robert Gerard Anderson. He's the director of the play Hit the Wall. We were also speaking with Madeline Whitesell, the play's dramaturg. Coming up after the break, we'll bring you our conversation about Illinois' sundown town history. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to a special encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today, we've been focusing on our history. After the Civil War and Reconstruction, white Southerners took action to restrict the rights of Black men, women, and families. Today, most of us know those as Jim Crow laws, and these laws were in many ways a backlash to the abolition of slavery. Well, according to historian and scholar James W. Lowen, another kind of backlash was happening in the North. Sundown towns, places where Black citizens were not only barred from living, but where they also wouldn't be safe if they stayed in town after dark. That's also one part of the movie Green Book, which came out last fall. Jim has been writing about this subject for years. His 2005 book, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism, is one of the few scholarly works on this topic. He's originally from Decatur and is now professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Vermont. I spoke with him last winter. Hi, Jim. Welcome to The 21st. Thank you for being with us.
Yes, I want to say hi to all my stomping grounds out there.
So, Jim, I mentioned that you are from Decatur. That's where you grew up. Did you know about sundown towns in Illinois when you were growing up here?
I did not. I did know that the little towns around Decatur didn't have any Black folks. Little towns like Monticello, Mount Zion, Blue Mound, and Iliopolis, all the little towns around Peoria, such as Metamora and Peoria Heights and so on, all the little towns around Springfield. Well, I didn't know that they were all sundown because I only lived in Decatur, but I knew they were all white. And then I actually had an aha moment doing this research, and it happened in Decatur. I was the keynote speaker for the second biennial Decatur Writers Conference. So there I am speaking in the Decatur Public Library to a nicely sized audience about my bestseller, Lies My Teacher Told Me. And I ended by telling them what I was now working on. This was in the year 2000. I was working on sundown towns. And I told them what a sundown town was, and I asked that if anybody knew anything about it, would they please come down afterward to talk with me? And to my astonishment, more than 20 people came down, and they told me stories about every little town around Decatur that I just mentioned.
Were they Black or white? Both?
Champaign. These are all white folks. And they told me that, for example, they told me that Villa Grove, which is near Champaign-Urbana, had a siren or whistle that sounded at 6 p.m. to tell Black folks to be gone. Well, I thought that was apocryphal. I mean, but it did tell me that two people told me that, and it did tell me that they both understood Villa Grove to be a sundown town and that it had a whistle. I thought it was probably a shift change at a factory. But sure enough, a year later, when I went to Villa Grove to check it out, I learned absolutely that the siren is on the water tower, that it indeed sounded for that purpose. Not everybody understood that, but many, many people did. So it was absolutely not safe for a black person to be in Villa Grove after that siren went off, and they had only stopped the siren in 1999. So I learned, in other words, that every one of these towns around all of these cities in central Illinois that was all white was not all white by accident. It was all white on purpose.
And when did this start? When did the history of when this became...
Mostly started pretty late. It wasn't obvious. It didn't come about before the Civil War or anything like that. Mostly it happened between 1890 and 1940. And historians have a name for this period. And this period is called the nadir of race relations. Well, several bad things happened in 1890 that caused us to date it precisely from then. One of them is the Mississippi Constitution got changed to openly forbid blacks from being citizens, from voting, from being on juries, and so on. And this is blatantly unconstitutional, but the United States did nothing about it. And so every other southern state and states as far away as Oklahoma followed suit by 1908. Things like that happened in 1890. And so during this period, 1890 to 1940, town after town in Illinois that had black populations pushed them out, sometimes violently, sometimes just cold-shouldering them out. Sometimes one person was lynched and the rest of the black community thought they better leave. And then if you didn't have a black population, like, for instance, as far as I know, Monticello didn't, but Monticello passed an ordinance. You can't find it, but the city attorney swears that they did pass one. Other people I've talked with who were on the city council and so on believe that they passed it. So that's when it happened, between 1890 and 1940. And there's lots of towns that had a black population up until maybe 1908 or 1910 or whenever, and then they didn't have one for decades.
Jim, did this happen in Illinois mostly in smaller towns? I imagine, was this in a larger place, like, I'm thinking particularly the size of a place like Springfield in the 1900s was pretty large?
Springfield in 1908 had the Springfield race riot, which was an attempt to make Springfield into a sundown town. And indeed, the white mob attacked the black community. They lynched two people, and they drove out two-thirds of the black population, and they yelled at them, "Abe Lincoln brought you in. We will drive you out." Now, they failed because it was just too big a project, and also because the governor had the notice. I mean, after all, he lives in Springfield. So on the second day, they finally called out the National Guard, and about half of the two-thirds that got driven out came back to Springfield. But in the aftermath of that riot, little satellite expulsions took place in little towns around Springfield. The biggest town that did go sundown was Pekin. Numbers of Chicago suburbs went sundown. Cicero was the most infamous. Cicero had little race riots in every year ending in one after World War II in 1951, 61, 71, and 81. So it was clearly a sundown town. And in fact, about 75% of the Chicago suburbs were sundown towns, and a couple of them still are.
So, Jim, regardless of whether or not when we think about slavery as sort of a defining, we tend to think of, I think, whether or not slavery was allowed as a way to define race relations in a state. But I wonder what the existence of laws like creating sundown towns, how that also affected race relations. That's kind of something we don't know that much about and don't talk about as much.
We don't. You're right. And not only that, we don't know about the nadir of race relations, this terrible period, 1890 to 1940. And that's the period when the North really solidified its racism. Of course, the South did, too. That is, it's the Jim Crow era. But when we think about Jim Crow, most people think about it in the South, that you got these, you know, white and colored bathrooms and stuff like that. And indeed, we never had that in Illinois, well, hardly ever. We didn't have that in the North, but we had all these sundown towns. That's particularly ironic. You mentioned in your introduction this new movie, The Green Book, Well, the
which
Green
is
Book,
not without controversy, I feel like I should also point out.
Yeah, well, I saw The Green Book. It's a good movie, but sociologically it's terrible. And here's the problem. It now is the fifth Hollywood movie that treats sundown towns, at least that I know of. And of those five that treat sundown towns, four put them in Mississippi and one puts them in Georgia. Now, I lived in Mississippi for years, so I tried to find every sundown town I could. I found three. Compare Illinois, my other home state. I found, I'm now at a count of 506. There's just no comparison. Now, in the Green Book, these folks go across Indiana, Illinois, and Iowa, and they never come to a sundown town. And then they encounter one in Mississippi. We have a tendency in America to put severe racism in the Deep South, and that gets the rest of us off the hook. But sundown towns are a Midwestern phenomenon. They're a phenomenon in Oregon. They're a phenomenon in Pennsylvania. And they're almost unheard of in the Deep South. The only place they exist in the Deep South is in the non-Deep South, like, for instance, the outside of Florida.
I wonder how you think African Americans throughout this period when this was being adopted in the 19th and 20th century, how did they respond and adapt to these sundown town laws?
Well, many of them responded by not going out much. That is to say, by not taking vacations, by not traveling much. One reason for that was because they could get in trouble. One of the major crossroads in America, in fact, I think they call themselves the Crossroads of Mid-America or something like that, is Effingham, Illinois. And Effingham had both two major railroad lines, the North-South line that still has the city of New Orleans, and also the main line of the New York Central that goes from New York to St. Louis, and St. Louis was a huge rail center. Well, those both were in Effingham, and also two major bus routes, namely north-south, which is now the interstate going from Chicago to Effingham south, and what was called the National Road going from Washington again to St. Louis. Well, if you actually, let's say, had a trip that took you to Effingham, and then you changed from bus to train or whatever, you had about a two-block walk, and that could be life-threatening. People were advised to take a taxi, black people. Especially if it was after dark, but even if it was before dark. So people knew about this stuff in the black community with or without the Green Book. The Green Book doesn't know too much about sundown towns because Mr. Green was in Harlem and he wasn't as familiar with the idea that as well, most black people didn't realize they were as widespread as I found them to be. So people in Illinois, in particular black people, just didn't travel as much. They were scared to travel. And when they did, they would go to big cities. If they're going to have a good time, they would go to Chicago. They would not go to, say, Branson, Missouri, where all kinds of white tourists go, because they knew that that wasn't for them. And indeed, Branson was probably a sundown town.
Jim, I wonder, as we're thinking about not just this Green Book and everyone watching this movie, and as you're saying, the historical inaccuracies or it sort of playing to misconceptions that racism was just in the South, I wonder, even apart from that, why you think we should be talking about this? Because I bet you talk to some people who say,
sure,
yeah, this was in our past. Why don't we just move forward as a country
now
instead of dwelling on this?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the answer is what we call second-generation sundown town problems. And Ferguson, Missouri, supplies a wonderful example. Everybody's heard of Ferguson, of course, because of, shall we say, the race riot or the racial disturbances that happened, 4 years ago. And Ferguson was one of the very few suburbs of St. Louis that actually had a small black population. But they put more and more pressure against it, and that black population dwindled from 60 in 1940 down to just 15 by 1960, which is when Ferguson attained sundown town status. And that dwindling happened while the overall population of Ferguson went from 5,000 to 20,000. So there's no reason for it other than overt pressure, including what we call DWB, or driving while black, policing. Well, Ferguson got over it. After 1960, they could no longer stem the tide, shall we say. And, of course, once several black families move into a former sundown suburb, it tends to go majority black quite quickly because the white population has already been exposed to the ideology that black folks are criminal and are terrible and we got to keep them out. And so as soon as, you know, that becomes impossible, then they say, holy moly, we got these terrible criminal people coming in. I'm going to sell. And that's what happened in Ferguson. Ferguson went about 67% black, but the police force stayed 99% white and continued to do DWB policing. And that's one example of a second-generation sundown town issue. Other examples of flick towns in Illinois. Pekin, for instance, has had problems of people harassing black athletes when they come visiting Pekin in cross-country or basketball or football. Just all kinds of bad things happening, even though Pekin now has a handful of black families and therefore is not literally a sundown town. So I think that every sundown town in Illinois needs to do something about it, even if it's beyond being a sundown town. I suggest a three-step program. One, admit it. We did this. And it's interesting. Some sundown towns won't even do that, even though we have the goods on them. Number two, we did it, and it was wrong, and we're sorry. In other words, apologize. And third, and we don't do it anymore. And that third step needs to have teeth. We are now hiring black cops. We're now hiring black garbage men and garbage women. We are now hiring black teachers, and we're making it possible for them to live in the city.
Jim, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. Jim Lowen is a historian. He's the author of Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. Thank you for being with
me. Might I add a plea? And my plea is to any listener who knows something about a town and its sundown tradition. I'm always trying to learn more, and at my website, I'm trying to compile a complete registry of all the sundown towns that there ever were. And so you might email me at jlowen, J-L-O-E-W-E-N, at uvm.edu, and tell me about the sundown town that you know about, and I'll get in an email conversation with you. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you, you too. That does it for us today. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On Facebook, if you search for the 21st to like us, it's another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, just head to our website, 21stshow.org. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.